Hello, 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 and welcome to another edition of the Firm Podcast on the Radio St. Pete Network. I am your host, Michael Duggar, and I hope everyone's having a good week. I'm recording this part of the show at early Friday morning on August 24th, and we don't really have... I'm going to break this up. I'm going to talk a little bit about the NFL for the first half, and then second half, I'm going to come back, do some research, and talk a little bit college football. Or maybe just talk college football in general, because it's usually the same teams at the top, and this year does not seem any different. With the Urban Meyer news, I'll hit on that. But begin today with some NFL talk, and the big news, at least in my eyes, is the Dallas Cowboys, and that with another offensive lineman going down injured. And this one's different. This is their all-pro center, Travis Frederick, and he came out earlier this week and said that he's battling, I'm not botching his name, it's an autoimmune disease, and I think it's called Guillain-Barré syndrome. And what it is that the Guillain-Barré causes the body to attack a network of nerves around the brain and spinal cord. Most people recover from even the most severe cases of this disease, but some will continue to have a degree of weakness, according to the National Institute for Neurological Disorders and Stroke. And, you know, health aside, Frederick came out and said that doctors have told him that there's no timetable for his return. He can miss multiple weeks of the season. He could miss the whole season. Everything, all that stuff is null and gray in terms of making sure that he is as healthy of a human being as possible outside of the field. So, And Frederick discovered this because I'm just reading this from an ESPN article. Last week in California, Frederick was examined by neck specialist, Dr. Robert Watkins, and he had symptoms similar to that of a stinger, which is when you get hit and it literally just stings your body in football especially. You just it stings and your arm goes numb for a little bit. And it's not a fun, it's not an enjoyable feeling to have. So when he, with the weakness not subsiding when the Cowboys returned to Dallas, he met with more specialists in Dallas, and the diagnosis of the Guillain-Barré syndrome was determined through blood work. So, like I said, we often don't really see these athletes as, sometimes we don't really see them as like human beings, stuff like through injury, especially with the rise of fantasy football, where we're like, oh, now, even my first thought was, oh, how is this going to affect Ezekiel Elliott's and Dallas Cowboy outlook? And that's just what's wrong with us. But then you think about it, you read about it, and it's like, you know, this is a serious disease, needs to be treated carefully, and he needs to go get himself healthy and all that stuff. So I'm glad that he's taking this time off, and there's no way he's going to try to battle through this, and he's not going to return until he's fully healthy. But for the sake of this podcast and this show, I am going to be the person, and I'm going to look how this affects the Dallas Cowboys season as a whole. And what the Dallas Cowboys have done over the past 5-6 years, is they've accumulated as many offensive linemen. They've used three first-round picks on offensive linemen. Tyron Smith at left tackle, Zach Martin right guard, Frederick center at the center position. And all three of those arguably are the best at their position in the NFL, if not top two, top three at least. And we see, and the one thing that's come about is when you have a team that is built through your offensive line, if one of those chain locks or two of them are out, the whole thing could fall apart. And last year we saw Tyron Smith go down. Let me make sure I'm saying his name right. Yeah, Tyron Smith. Yeah, okay. If we're looking at Tyron Smith's case, last year he missed some games with the back. He has chronic back issues, and he always has. He's a big guy. He's 6'5", 312. He's a pretty great athlete too. But he has chronic back issues, and he missed a couple games last year. And we saw the Cowboys, I wouldn't say season flounder, but you saw how difficult it was for Zeke to get fine running lanes, and Dak Prescott to have a clean pocket to operate, and their offense just tanked. for lack of better words. And that's only with Smith out. And the game that stands out is local Tampa Catholic, a player that I played high school basketball with a little bit, and he was in some of my classes when I went to school at TC, Chaz Green. He came in and filled in at left tackle for a primetime game against the Atlanta Falcons, and former Bucks draft pick Adrian Claiborne torched him for tied an NFL record for 6 sacks in one game. So that Chaz Green experience was done in one game at that time. So we saw the impact that it had. Tyron Smith's out. So now that Smith is healthy, his two other counterparts, the two other chain links of that, of the Cowboys' high investments in draft capital, are not healthy at all. Zach Martin has a knee injury. All signs are pointing toward he's going to be ready for week 1, but knee injuries on big linemen and stuff like that, those are not the most predictable those are not really predictable to project how long and how, how dominant he can be. And so to counteract that, you have Travis Frederick in the center position, who I just said, who may not even play this season, could be back in 4 or 5 weeks, but we don't know. There's massive holes on the interior of this offensive line now. And yes, offensive line injuries would offset a lot of things. And the Cowboys have some nice depth with Leo Collins. They can do some things around. Joe Looney's going to step in as their center. But a team that's so reliant on the run and so reliant, I mean, a lot of teams are like, every team wants to have a clean pocket. But if you go back and look at their 14-2 season just 2 years ago with Dak and Zeke when they were rookies, Dak was never under pressure. Zeke had running lanes everywhere. And now that these two guys are gone, potentially, defenses are going to tee off in the middle of them. They're not going to put their best pass rusher on Tyron Smith when they can throw out their weak link. And like I've talked about this before, is that defenses are getting smarter now, and they're putting their best pass rushers on the interior because they see that guards and centers usually are not the best pass blockers, and they're more run blocking, stuff like that. But now they're getting more athletic and stuff like that. The NFL's adapting. It's always changing and stuff like that. But week 1, they play the Panthers. Dontari Poe, Kawan Short. Those are studs, and they're going to be all up in Dak's face. They're going to be stopping the run. So that's just week 1. And then you look at for the season as a whole, if these two are not healthy and they already have the question mark of how long Tyron Smith can last with his back issues, it's a scare. This should be worrying Cowboys fans, and especially because I didn't think that the Cowboys were going to be that great this year anyway, because I don't like their offensive weapon. I don't like their offensive weapons at the receiver. Although Michael Gallup, a rookie out of Colorado State, is looking pretty decent in preseason, and Dax looks sharp in his. And I didn't really watch much of the second game, but the first I watched one drive against the 49ers, and he placed a beautiful ball to Gallup, and he looks sharp. But this is not good. This is not a good look if you're a Cowboys fan. So I don't know. I don't really want to. I mean, I guess that'll lead to a little this talk about this division as a whole, because this is actually a pretty unhealthy division. Because the Eagles at the top, the Eagles have question marks. I mean, we're going to get into Nick Foles' performance in this last preseason game in a second, but he returned from a shoulder injury, by the way. I know I said some things last podcast about how it looked worse than it actually was. So, but all signs are pointing towards he's fine, and he's ready to play week 1 if they choose him. But Tim Journey, they have some injuries on the D-line. Jason Kelce briefly exited the game last night but came in on the offensive line. Jason Peters did not play, and we saw the backup exit the game. And when he wasn't exiting the game, he couldn't block. He was getting manhandled on the left tackle and left side. So the Eagles still have some questions. I'm sure Jason Peters is ready to play, so he'll be fine. And then the Giants, Saquon Barkley hasn't practiced in 2 weeks. They invest a first-round pick in a player of his caliber. He hasn't done anything. Odell will be ready for week 1, but he is not. He hasn't appeared in preseason, probably won't, and he's just now getting to 100%. But Saquon not being there, that completely changes their whole offense once again. Assume it's just precautionary reasons for him being held out. And the Redskins lost Darius Geis, their running back, who was supposed to be their difference maker, and they bring in Adrian Peterson. So This division gets a lot of hype because they're in a lot of major markets. The Cowboys are one of the most valuable franchises in the world. Giants are in New York and generate a lot of buzz. They have two Super Bowls in the past 10 years. I mean, 11 years. So they generate a lot of buzz. And they have a lot of glamour. They have a lot of well-known faces in Odell and Eli Manning. And now Saquon. You go to the Eagles. They're defending Super Bowl champions. Carson Wentz. We don't know if he's going to be ready for week one, week two. We don't know when they're going to push him. And if they are going to push him, how is that going to affect him and stuff like that? What else is it? And then Washington, it's in the nation's capital. Another big market, and big name owner. Just a lot of talk, not well talked, but a lot of organizations that are always at the forefront and have been around for a long time. So you look at those. But this division has not been as talented and deep in terms of team quality in some time. The division for the past like 4 years, whoever's finished last has then gone to win the division. This year, that'd be the Giants. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Pat Shurmur, their new head coach, is a great coach. I just don't think that's going to happen because their talents, they don't have the talent. I'm still worried about their offensive line. I think they have the worst quarterback in the whole division, and that's by a landslide. I think the Giants are going to finish third. I thought the Cowboys were going to finish last in this division regardless, and now you throw in their offensive line question marks, which is literally what the team is built around. I think they're pegged. I think that's that last is going to look a lot smarter. And then I've always been big on the Redskins. I've talked about this before. They've invested in a lot of draft capital in their front seven. They have a great pass rush and duo in Ryan Kerrigan let me look real quick. Edge rushers. Let me look. Pernell McPhee is one. Why don't they give me more? Anyway. So they have a strong defensive line. Ryan Kerrigan's one of the most underrated players. Preston Smith's a good middle linebacker. Their back end, they have been so impressed with their rookies that they released a solid quarterback. Oh, Preston Smith, that's who it is. Yes, Preston Smith is the pass rusher. So I was right. They've invested so much draft capital into their D-line, and they've drafted and developed good secondary talent, that they let Orlando Scandrick go, former Cowboy, who's a pretty average to above-average slot corner, and that's tough to find, especially when you trade Kendall Fuller for Alex Smith, who was one of the better slot corners than Fuller that was. So they love the rookie corner DBs. They have Josh Norman, who may not be at his Carolina Panthers level, is still a great corner. DJ Swearinger in the back end. And then that's the defensive side of things. I just love their offense, though. I think we've seen what Jay Gruden can do with the one-dimensional quarterback in Kirk Cousins. And if you've listened to this podcast at all, you should be surprised with how much, not disdain, but how much I think Kirk Cousins is overrated. And I'm a huge Alex Smith fan. He gets a lot of bad rap for not pushing the ball on the field, not being able to make all the big time throws. But I think those are overblown. We saw him make a lot of throws, a lot of great down the field throws last year. And the fact that he doesn't turn the ball over, he can run. He can run a read option. You can do a lot of things with him that Kirk Cousins couldn't do. And Kirk Cousins is not, maybe he's not as, he's a lot, maybe not super turnover prone-y. That's a word I just made up. But Alex Smith just doesn't turn the ball over. You know, takes what the defense gives you. And they're going to run, I talk about this, they run the clearing routes. They have a lot of deep threats now. Jameson Crowder, middle of the field. Paul Richardson, Josh Doctson can get down the field. That's going to open up so many underneath routes for one of the best pass catching backs in Chris Thompson. One of the best tight end duos in Vernon Davis and Jordan Reed, if Jordan Reed could stay healthy. So I can talk about them all day. I just love what they're going to do. And I don't know if they're going to win. I don't know if I'm ready to pull the trigger and say they're going to beat the Eagles, because the Eagles are ridiculously talented and well coached on both sides of the ball. And the only thing about the Eagles is I think Nick Foles is a good quarterback. He's Super Bowl MVP. That got the book deal. You know, went from almost retiring to leading a team to the Super Bowl and got all that stuff. But I know torn ACLs aren't what they used to be, but all of this just rushing back Carson Wentz just is really just like keeping me uneasy. And I don't know if it's me just. It's tough to repeat in the NFL, and having one of the best rosters in football helps. But there's a lot of question marks on this offense right now. They don't have Jay Ajayi is banged up, and he hasn't been the most quote unquote durable running back, although he was used sparingly last year, except until the playoffs. Alshon Jeffrey is coming back from a torn rotator cuff. We don't know when he's gonna be ready. Nelson Aguilar, the other receiver, has been battling lower body issue all preseason, didn't play last night against Cleveland. And Wentz, you know, we're talking about, like I just said, the ACL thing, you know, we see people come back all the time from them in just glowing form and glowing stuff like that, but are we sure? It's just, he's one bad tackle away. He's one bad plan away. And that's to say to everybody, but you want that knee to be as 100%. We're talking about a quarterback for the next 10 to 12 years. This isn't, you know, run him out there, especially because this division's weak. So the Eagles could afford to throw Nick Foles or Nate Sudfeld out there for weeks 1 through 4 and let that knee heal up for as long as possible. That extra month would prove dividends. You know, I saw some highlights that he's moving really well, but it's just like a worrisome injury that it can just happen again in a flash. And the Eagles defense can win for them. And it's not their Eagles offense, their coaching staff. They can divide up a full game plan for their opponent. I mean, they ran a draw on 3rd and 11 last night, beautifully designed, where the whole line, I'm just talking about one play, where the whole line just shifted out. And I was just like, yeah, they can make this work for a little bit. They have plenty of running backs when they're healthy. Ajayi, Corey Clement, Darren Sproles is still there and stuff like that. So, I mean, I would just want them to be smart. And this division as a whole, I mean, it's just like, you know, we see these teams play every single week in primetime that they're like ingrained in our heads that these are some of the most historic franchises. I mean, the Giants have 4 Super Bowls. Cowboys have 5 Super Bowls. Let me double check that. Redskins have 2, and the Eagles just got their 1. So, yeah, Cowboys have 5. So these have, this division accounts for 9, 10, 12 of the 50 Super Bowls. That's almost a quarter of the Super Bowls. That's a fifth of the Super Bowls in this one division, you know. That's impressive. But we need to take a step back. Realize that a lot of this hype is generated from the media. A lot of this hype is generated by getting clicks, you know. Skip Bayless has made a living just talking about the Cowboys for 4 segments a show the past 10 years. Kudos to him, though. You can make a career like that. I mean, who am I to judge? It's a pretty good career to have. But I'm just there's so many other better divisions in this NFL. The NFC North, AFC North, NFC South, AFC West. I mean, there's just so much excitement, and then but this division, I mean, it's leading my show, so who am I to say? But all that was like a Cowboys conversation turned into how this affects the division, because I wanted to interlink those two. Even though it doesn't really affect it in my eyes that much, this could be a terrible year for the Cowboys, even more so. So, we'll see. That's all we can say. We're going to leave the NFC East. Well, we're not really going to leave the NFC East, because we're going to be talking about one of the teams in the NFC East, and that is the Philadelphia Eagles, who took on the Cleveland Browns last night in a rollicking game that finished 5-0, with the Browns winning with their 1 safety and their 1, how long was the field goal, and a 54-yard field goal. So, hey, good for you, Zane Gonzalez, kicker of the Browns, getting your
getting a little bit of shine right there.
But this was a pretty ugly game, to put it lightly. I mean, depending on how you view football, a lot of people say, you know, we love defensive battles. So if you love defensive battles, then you came to the right place, because there wasn't a lot of offense, wasn't a lot of great pass blocking, somewhat great run blocking. I touched a couple minutes ago about how there was a beautiful run design by Doug Peterson and the Eagles, but it was pretty, I don't even know the proper way to say it. So we'll start with the Eagles side of things, and Nick Foles, I thought that shoulder injury was a lot more serious than it actually was. I thought that he would miss a couple games, maybe even give the Bucs a break, but even if he does play, it could be a win for the Bucs, which would be nice, because if you look at his performance, you know, look at the stat line in terms of completion and yardage, he was 13 for 17, 127 yards, but he had two picks and a fumble and a safety, and it was just an ugly night. And to his credit, he didn't have the full offensive weaponry. He had Zach Ertz, who had three of his four catches on the first drive. Then they kind of like went away from him. But no Alshon. Mike Wallace was there, but you know, Mike Wallace isn't a guy you can rely on as your lone target. You need other help around him. So he was dealing with the likes of Shelton Gibson and, you know, DeAndre Carter, who actually looked like the best offensive player for the Eagles on the field the whole night. He is a rookie from Sacramento State, or second-year player. He looked great. He was returning punts, returning kicks, but this was just an abysmal showing for them. And their ground game, they also didn't have Ajayi, Clement, Sproles, but Wendell Smallwood had a nice average of 12 carries, 53 yards, and he looked physical and running. He's always a guy who, especially if you're like a fantasy football player over the past 2 years, he's a guy that, you know, you've hoped for because you see the physical tools, but opportunity hasn't been there. And when he has gotten his opportunity, he hasn't performed up to those expectations. So it's just a weird mix of running backs. Josh Adams, a rookie from Notre Dame who went undrafted, Notre Dame had one of the best O-lines last year, but he looked great. So, I mean, we're going far away from what the Eagles were supposed to be talking about, but it's the quarterback position. It could be a preseason game and not the full arsenal of weapons are there and just a couple interceptions, but he made terrible throws, like really bad throws for those interceptions. He was like rolling and literally just threw it right to the guy. He should have had another interception, but the Browns guy opted to bat it down instead of pick it, and then he could have had a pick six. And you're looking at the Eagles' schedule, games 1 through 3. And week one at hosting the Falcons, Nick Foles beat them in the playoffs. I don't know if that's going to happen again. It's a tough game if Wentz is not there. Because I think the Falcons are I don't think they're like a sleeping giant, but their defense is incredibly fast, and they have a scheme that everyone in the defense understands that is enhanced by speed, underrated D-line, and their offense is there, and I think they're going to take a step forward with Steve Sarkisian calling plays. And then go to Tampa, which is going to be the battle of backup quarterbacks, most likely. You know, that game, I mean, you look at Nick Foles at home versus the road splits, it could be another bad start. And then they host the Colts, which their D-line will probably take care of business. But then they go to the Titans, Vikings, Giants. Like, this is a tough – then Panthers, Jaguars. This is a tough schedule. This is a really tough schedule the Eagles have this year. And if they don't get off to a fast start, even before Wentz gets back, yes, the division's not that good. But I don't think Foles – I think if Foles plays the first four games, they go 1-3, 2-2 at the very best. And then you're going to throw Wentz into the fire – against the Vikings, that's scary. And then you're going to throw Wentz into the Lions, not the Lions. We're going to throw Wentz at the Meadowlands in the Giants, and then the Panthers, and then the Jaguars, and then it's just like, you know, I'm looking at the schedule. The easiest games they play are the Cowboys, and maybe the Bucks and Colts. this is a tough schedule. So Doug Peterson, their head coach, came out and said he was just disgusted by the whole offense, and Foles in particular. So Foles has, he will probably won't play in week four. He needs to get better decision making with the ball. I don't know if Jeffrey's going to be back. I doubt it. Let me check on Nelson Aguilar real quick, see how he's doing. Injury. It's funny because every time you type in a player's name, the first thing that comes up is fantasy football. Every single time. It's really comical. Let me look it up. Nelson Aguilar hasn't played this preseason. He's still not playing. So that's not worrisome, but it's getting to the point where we're 2 weeks out of the record. We're less than 2 weeks away, 13 days away from kicking off the NFL season where they're playing on opening night, and he's not out of practice. And if they go in with no weapons, they're going to get, that's bad. But the player that generated a lot of hype behind him was Nate Sudfeld, I think a secondary year quarterback. And they were like, oh, you know, maybe he played so well and he was lights out in the first two preseason games, maybe he'll push him. He was 11 for 21 with 72 yards and a 3.4 passing average. He made a great throw to, I think, Gibson. That was ruled touchdown and overturned, which was a great, beautiful throw to the back of the end zone. And receiver made a great attempt to make the catch. He just couldn't get that. It was like an inch or two. His foot was out of bounds. So I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know. They're going to have to run that defense because that defense is nasty. Defense had four sacks last night. They had a goal line stand. They gave up, the safety wasn't their fault. That was coming off of, that was a goal line stand they had. And their field goal was a long field goal, which came off a Nick Foles turnover or Matt Jones turnover, one of the two. So looking at this, their D line was crazy efficient last night. Oh, that's a safety. Let me look at it. Fletcher Cox left the game. He looked great. And they didn't even have their full unit. Michael Bennett. I'm just looking at their D line. It's crazy. Derek Barnett looks like he's turned the corner. It's just Haloti Ngata, Chris Long, Michael Bennett. Gosh, they're a crazy good line. Josh Sweat, rookie from Florida State, made a phenomenal play in the backfield to make a tackle. He's going to be there. Timmy Jernigan's not playing. This all comes down to their secondary, and if their secondary can keep improving, then this defense will be just as good. And they're like a yard. My favorite thing about this defense is their defense coordinator, Jim Schwartz. And I'm looking at him last night. He doesn't have a play script. Doesn't have a play card. He knows like the six or seven plays he's going to run. And he just calls it out there, just dialing up blitzes. It's like a mastermind on the side. Maybe that's a bad thing. It's a good thing. But this defense gives up chunks of yards. But they just go for the big play. They go for the big sack. And that's the type of defense. I love aggressive defenses. They're most fun to watch. And they're that level that raises the level of turnover probability. So I love the Jim Schwartz defense. And then they really stymied this Browns passing game. And we're going to move to the Browns. And the main thing, I'll try not to go on, but it's just the Browns have been on hard knocks. The Browns are playing on primetime Thursday night games and Friday night games. So it's tough to not talk about them, especially because they have the number one pick, a player I love, in Baker Mayfield. And he's duking it out with Tyrod Taylor. And I watched Tyrod Taylor, and everyone in Cleveland held their breath for a little bit. But for the first time when they held their breath, because Tyrod, I'm going to call him by his name, he wants to be called Tyrod. On that same goal line stand I was just discussing, was running out of bounds. He was running on fourth and goal. They didn't run the ball. I don't know why they didn't run the ball. He throws the ball out, but he lands, and it looks like his left wrist just completely snaps. He runs off the field immediately, goes to the locker room. Everyone's like, oh, man, you know, Cleveland season's already done. But here's the thing. For the first time in probably ever, they're built to handle their starting quarterback getting injured, because Baker Mayfield, people think he should be starting already. I don't, but people were just like, okay, we got Baker now. And then Baker plays a series or two, and Tyrod comes back out. And, you know, they didn't really do anything with the ball. They had like a two-minute drive. I mean, this passing game was just null and void the whole time. And that's a lot has to do with, because Philadelphia was just
in their quarterback's face, and they were the quarterback's running for life every single time, at will, it seemed. So Baker finished 8 for 12, 76 yards in a bad interception. He got sacked twice. Tyrod had 11 for 16, 65 yards, and two sacks as well. So not the best night for the quarterbacks, but you could see their mobility. And what they do is Baker scrambled for a couple first downs. He evaded a lot of tacklers in the pocket. And that's something he's going to do. He's built. He looks like a mini Ben Roethlisberger back there in terms of shedding off tacklers. And he's quicker than Ben, but he does such a good job of keeping his eyes down the field as he's navigating the pocket. And he's throwing off rushers. And if he gets out of the pocket, the defense has to honor him a little bit because he's going to scramble for a first down. He's not the type of quarterback who's just going to run out of bounds and just take and like not absorb the contact. Another thing that does is that if defenses start locking in on him and come up for the run, he's just going to pass the ball because his eyes are always downfield. But the main takeaway offensively for the Browns was their ground game once again. Last week they had a big game on the ground. This week they did. Not a big game. I guess they did. They had over a 4-yard average. Their whole team was 34 carries for 138 yards. But Carlos Hyde, once again, looks great. Looks explosive. Shedding tacklers, navigating the offensive line. Nick Chubb behind him had the biggest workload once again. He looks like he's not a year away, but he looks like he had his one first carry with the first team offense had 21 yards. He busted through two tacklers. And then they have Duke Johnson, who's the pass catching back, 3 carries, 13 yards. You know, he hasn't been proven to be a threat in the ground game yet. But in terms of what, like splitting him out wide and doing things to get him involved in the pass game, he's going to be a factor. He was on the field for most of the third downs and the passing down situations for the Browns. But the main reason this offense is going to open up the run game is because they have two quarterbacks in Tyrod and Baker, Tyrod especially, who can make plays with their feet, and you have to honor them or they're going to make you pay. So I know we're all talking about the hype about this passing offense and stuff like that, but they're going to be effective if they can run the ball. And if they can run the ball effectively, they have the pass catchers and the weapons to become a powerful offense. Because we see Landry's going to be great over the middle. First play of the game, they go right to him, he gets 11 yards. Rashard Higgins, he's looking pretty solid. And Njoku, the tight end, looking good. And then you have Josh Gordon just waiting in the works. All signs are pointing towards he's in shape, he's looking good, and that just brings you just add in one of the 5 most talented wide receivers. Yes, he is a top 5 talent offensively. I mean, at the receiver position in all of football, it's going to be everything is there for this offense to be great. I believe Jarvis Landry when he said that this team could put up 40 points on everybody if they play to their potential. And getting Josh Gordon back, that's a big thing. But their defense, once again, a defensive performance stood out. Myles Garrett, number one pick in the 2017 draft. He was everywhere. He had 3 tackles, 2 sacks, 2 QB hits outside of that. Like, he was destroying Vitali, the left tackle, bull rushing him. He showed everything that he had. I think I saw a stat, 40% of dropbacks on pass rushing situations when Garrett was in the game, he had a hit or a sack. That's just crazy numbers. Jabril Peppers looked good. Denzel Ward, their number 4 pick, left the number 4 pick in this past draft, the cornerback from Ohio State. He left the game with a back injury, but he had 3 tackles in his time, and his cover skills are what's going to be his biggest, is what he's going to be relied on. If he can tackle, that's just a bonus. That's what separates the great corners from the good corners. Yes, you know, your job is to stop the other team from, like, shut down their passing game. But if you can come up and make a tackle on the run, because that's a lot. It's a lot of quick plays, a lot of wide receiver screens, running back screens. You have to shed a tackler and make a one-on-one tackle, that play's gone. So him showing a bonus that he's willing to put his face in is going to be good. It's just, there's a lot of youth. There's a nice mix of youth and veteran leadership and veteran players on this defense. And if they can all come together, there's a lot of ifs with this team. It's a lot of ifs. So I don't want to keep talking about this team. But the last thing I'm going to mention about the Browns. It's not even really about the Browns. It's, if you watched the episode of Hard Knocks, you saw Dez Bryant come into the picture. Dez Bryant came in for a visit to the Cleveland Browns. It was a really weird thing. It was like a recruiting thing where he was meeting everyone, talking about how the interviewed with the radio announcers, met the trainers, met the equipment staff, was dapping up everyone. He looked, I mean, in terms of a recruiter, and you're watching him, and you're an NFL team who is a receiver heavy, who's watching him, you're just like, hey, this guy seems like he's trying to prove that he's a good organizational player that is friendly to everyone and stuff like that. So if there's anything that got misconstrued in Dallas, not to worry about that because he's happy. He just wants a chance. And it's just really strange to see. I mean, I guess it's not strange to see, but the NFL leader in touchdowns outside of the quarterback position is unsigned. And I understand that he has a limited route tree, that he, maybe that was Dallas's fault, maybe that was his own fault. But why wouldn't someone take a chance? There's a lot of receiver needy teams. The Browns may are still interested in him. If they add him to the mix, that's going to affect the red zone. We saw last night, the Browns didn't have, they drew up a bunch of crossing patterns and fades to like Jarvis Landry in the end zone. When you have Dez, or throw Josh Gordon away for now, but if you have Dez Bryant, that's what he does best, is he wins jump balls. He can run a slant in the thing and out muscle someone to the middle of the field and make a catch. Like, you don't bring him in to get 100 targets and try to get 1,200 yards. You get him in there to get 8 touchdowns. Make him like your Jimmy Graham that Seattle did last year, where important plays, you understand his limitations in terms of route tree, like 12-yard comeback. Okay, do that. Go route, slant. Maybe he's worked on expanding his route tree. Maybe it's too little, too late, but he's only 29. The guy is great when we've seen what he, I don't know. It's just, maybe we overthink it a little too much at, maybe we overthink all of these, you know, I guess personalities and the meshing of them is a big deal. But it doesn't, I mean, maybe Dallas, he just overstayed his visit in Dallas. And I'm looking at some teams. Okay, just a little side note. I'm just scrolling on some, reading some news and stuff like that. Tyrod Taylor's x-rays on his wrist came back negative, so he should be good going forward. Anyways, like, I'm looking at these wide receiver needy teams, and why wouldn't you want a threat like this? And the team that keeps being brought up is the New England Patriots, who cut Kenny Britt, they cut Malcolm Mitchell, and they have enough receiver threat strictly because it's Brady, and Brady can make everyone great, and they're trying this project with Cordell Patterson. But Julian Edelman's out for the first 4 games. He's not a red zone per se jump ball threat. They have Gronk and Chris Hogan, who are great red zone threats. But in the NFL, you sometimes need to have more than just 3 receiving threats, because Edelman missed all of last season. Chris Hogan missed, I think, like, he missed a good portion of the season. And Gronk's always an injury question. So you throw Dez in there as like a nice safety valve. You understand he's going to be in a culture where he's not going to be able to act out. He's going to come in, he's going to do his job, and if he doesn't, he'll get cut immediately, and then his career's probably over. Just like that. That's coming. If you do it the Patriot way, or you don't do it at all. So I'm looking at that team. I'm looking at some other wide receiver. Let me look at the NFL list real quick. But I think him, maybe not a Randy Moss revitalization like that, up to that level, but it's something that they should be looking at, because Brady makes everyone great. And the window for the Patriots is now. We're approaching the end of their window. Whenever Brady retires, if they don't have a quick succession plan, that window's closed, and it's closed immediately.
Because then Gronk has threatened to retire plenty of times. We don't know how much longer Belichick will be there. There's a lot of questions. So I'm going to look at the rosters real quick and just go through them and try to think. The Ravens are lurking. I heard he turned down a contract offer from them. Don't know if that was the smartest thing to do because I feel like he would have been a good red zone threat for them. They have Michael Crabtree, but you have Crabtree and Bryant with those two tight ends. In the red zone, that's pretty lethal. Let's pick your poison. You're going to have man-to-man with someone who's going to win a jump ball. Panthers, no. Bills, no. Bears, no. Bengals. I like the Bengals' young receivers. I like Tyler Boyd, John Ross. They have A.J. Green. Auden Tate's coming up. Browns, maybe. Cowboys. It's funny that the Cowboys, circling back to them, the Cowboys release a player at their worst position by a mile. Michael Gallup, Allen Hurns, Terrence Williams, Cole Beasley. Not really the murderer's row of wide receivers, but they know what they're doing. Denver, no. Detroit Lions, no. Golden Tate, Kenny Galladay. My homie, Kenny Galladay. I'm drafting him in every league I can grab. Green Bay, there were some murmurs about him. And maybe they still do get him. Even though I don't know if this is a legit report, but there was something going around that they were shopping Randall Cobb, which means they believe in Equanimeous St. Brown and Geronimo Allison and their young receivers, which is a complete 180 from Aaron Rodgers cussing them out and throwing them under the bus in preseason. Not even in preseason, in training camp at an interview. He said they were goofing off. They was terrible. A lot of language I can't use on here. Houston Texans, no. I think they're pretty content with Carew, New Hopkins, and Will Fuller. Colts, I kind of think Colts would be a pretty smart place. They don't really have a red zone threat at wide receiver. They have T.Y. Hilton, who can stretch the field and do a lot of things. Jack Doyle, Eric Ebron, those are two big tight ends and bulk and big bodies. But I think they could use another receiver there, and they're playing indoors, so that dome will be, so it'll be fine. I mean, I'm trying to think of, for the reason I'm doing this is because I'm trying to look at the teams and be like, who could use a red zone threat? Because that's what you have to use Dez as. And it's 3rd and 6, you want to run a slant or a jump ball too, you know, this is when Dez Bryant comes on the field. And that's why I'm picking these teams out, the Colts. So I think the Colts, yes. Jaguars, no, I think they have too many of the same receivers. And I think they run the ball too much to require bring on another receiver. And they already have Marquise Lee, Keelan Cole, D.D. Westbrook. And they signed Dante Moncrief, so maybe they could use another receiver. Chiefs, no. Chargers, no. Chargers, I like them. Tyrell Williams, Mike Williams, Travis Benjamin. They need a tight end. But my favorite receiver, Keenan Allen, in football plays for them. So Rams, no. They have a bunch of small receivers, which is another weird thing. They don't really have like a legit red zone threat in the pass game outside of Gurley, which is, I mean, I understand Tyler Higbee, who actually is from the Tampa Bay area, played at Eastlake. I actually played against him in Little League football, Eastlake Eagles versus Luch Chiefs. It was kind of so it's always cool to see little people you play Little League against getting up in the NFL. But so the Rams could, I just don't think they want the headache, and I think they have a certain style about their receiving core. Dolphins have every single type of receiver you can imagine. I mean, they brought in Albert Wilson and Danny Amendola, let Jarvis Landry go. Still have Kenny Stills under contract, extending Kenny Stills, and have Devontae Parker. Devontae Parker is still to this day the best college football player I've seen with my own two eyes, and it has been really upsetting to watch him stagnate and not live up to that potential in Miami. Maybe he needs a new home to live up to his potential, but it's just really disappointing. That's one of the different things. Vikings, no. They got Kyle Rudolph, Thielen, Stephon Diggs. Patriots just talked about. Saints, no. They got Michael Thomas. That's all you need. And they're going to run the ball. Breeze is going to get an uptick in touchdowns, but that's going to go to Ben Watson, the tight end. That's going to go to I'm trying to think. What other receivers they have? They got rid of some receivers. I forgot they got rid of receivers. Cameron Meredith, Tre'Quan Smith.
Oh, they got Tegan Jr., the homie. So, I mean, yeah, they have their little mixes, and they just produce, they scheme you open, and they have that player they identify. I don't think Des Brown matches up with that. Giants, Odell, Sterling Shepard, maybe. There was talk that he wanted to. I mean, I know that Des wanted to play within the NFC East and played the Cowboys twice, but I don't think the Giants want that headache. The Jets, no, they have Robbie Anderson, Jermaine Kearse, they have a bunch of people. Oakland, no, I think they have enough old time talent to add Des Bryant to the mix. Then you go to Philly. You could say Philly, but I don't think they would want. I mean, if you look at the receiver depth last night, you would say, yeah, they could use a Des Bryant, but I don't think that. Pittsburgh, no. San Francisco 49ers, no. Seahawks, maybe? I mean, depends how Brandon Marshall looks in camp. I could see the Seahawks taking a chance. They believe in their culture almost to a fault up there in terms of bringing in players that have trouble past. Not trouble past, but like checkered past and are headaches and stuff like that. But look at the receivers, and they have Tyler Lockett. Doug Baldwin slow to get back from the injury, and then Brandon Marshall, who is coming off did he tear his ACL or his Achilles? I mean, I think he tore his ACL. Brandon Marshall injury. He had ankle surgery. Okay, so we don't know how dominant he's going to be when he returns to the mix. But, I mean, I could see that because Russell Wilson also lost a lot of touchdowns and Jimmy Graham going to the Packers. But we'll see that. Bucks, no. I'm going to wait. I'm going to talk a little about the Bucks after this. Well, I'm going to wait. I'm going to watch the game Friday night, come back and give some thoughts about the Bucks and some other NFL preseason thoughts for the last half of the show. But not the Bucks. I've talked about their receiver death. Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, Adam Humphries, DeSean Jackson, Justin Watson, Bobo Wilson. Just those are... In terms of six receivers deep, they have one of the best depth charts there. Tennessee Titans, nope. I think they have too many mouths to feed there as well. And same for the Washington Redskins. They have the red zone threat in Josh Doctson. That's set the receiver position. That's not even talking about the tight end position. So, I don't know where he's going to go. I don't know if anyone's going to go. Do I think they should? Absolutely. I think that he is a talented, I think he's still a talented receiver who has a role in terms of red zone threat and helping people out. So, there you go. I'm going to leave that. Let me look at the NFL news real quick, see if there's anything else I missed. Come on, internet. No. Okay. Leave the NFL at bay for now. I just want to talk because I have about 12 minutes before I have to go to the second half show. So I'm just going to talk about this real quick. And that is the NBA rules. And they're expected to pass rule changes for the 2018-2019 season. And I look at them, I'm just like, man, this is going to be crazy. It's something that we haven't seen before. So one thing about the NBA is you get a shot clock. Shot clock's 24 seconds. For then that means you have 24 seconds to get a shot up. The shot has to hit the rim. If it doesn't hit the rim, the buzzer, I'm explaining this for people who aren't familiar with basketball that much. And if the ball doesn't hit the rim, it airballs, hits the backboard or whatever, or you just don't get a shot off, it's a turnover, ball goes the other way. You make the shot, obviously, the ball gets inbound and goes the other way. But if you hit the rim, offensive rebound, the shot clock resets 24 seconds. The proposed rule that probably will pass is that an offensive rebound will now net you 14 seconds instead of 24. That's 10 extra less seconds. And I like this rule a lot. And I'm reading the article and they say, the NBA believes that the resetting of the shot clock to 14 seconds after offensive rebounds will increase shot attempts, especially at the end of close games. And that's something. It's like, say you shoot up a shot with 30 seconds left at the end of the game. Get the offensive rebound. 26 seconds left on the clock because it takes a couple seconds to all that stuff to reset. The game's pretty much over. just like that. Now you get to 14 seconds, they have 12 seconds. Now you can make a play. So the game is not essentially over after you get one defensive stop. So it's kind of rewarding. This is going to be more rewarding for the offense. But, I mean, why not? And the NBA studied FIBA's implementation of the rule in 2014. FIBA is the, I think it's the Federal International Basketball Association, stuff like that. And it was used in the G League, the WNBA, and NBA Summer League games. So it's going to take some time for the, I don't think it's going to take a lot of time for the players to get used to it, but it's going to be a rule that I like what it's going to do. Cause you know, you watch some of these hardwood classic games on NBA TV and you see how slow the game is and how slow the tempo is, especially if you get an offensive rebound. So I really think that I got thrown off for a second. I like these changes. I mentioned that as a bunch of times, that change alone, because you want the game to be quicker. You don't want it to be a slog grind out game. You want to see these players moving as fast as possible. You want to see everybody pushing the tempo, pushing the pace, and offensive rebounds. This is just going to be now. It's just going to be, you know, more aesthetically pleasing for people to not see offensive rebounds. And another thing is, a lot of teams don't even go for offensive rebounds anymore. They're more focused on getting back on transition. Good for them, and that's something that's cool and all, but it's, I don't know. I'm actually thinking about it. I slept on it. I saw this rule change. Let it sit on me. Now I'm like reading about it a little more, and I'm talking about it out loud. And I'm just like, I guess I understand why they made the rule change to speed up the game, but there's been like a decrease in offensive rebounds. So teams are going to be less incentivized to do offensive rebounds, even more so now that they know they can't get. That it's going to take a little longer to get their full offense set up and stuff like that. Because if you want to run these plays and stuff, it takes about 10 seconds to get them going and stuff like that. But I guess people don't even get up half the court when the defense is set to like 18 seconds. So it's only 4 seconds longer. So, and everyone's already down on that side of the court. So I think I don't think it's going to be that big of a change. You know, I'm saying this now, but I haven't seen it in action, really. I know I saw it sometimes in the summer league, and you don't even really catch it, because it's just something that you don't really look for. But we'll see that. And the other one is the change to the clear path rule. And the clear path foul is when, usually, so say the person gets a rebound, and it's a soccer foul. And soccer foul is like, you know, they're on a break, and you just foul them to stop the fast break. But in the basketball, it is, if you're the last defender and the person has an open layup and transition after a steal, you just reach out, grab them, it's a foul, and they get two free throws in the ball. Now they have changed the clear path rule, and they have to be in these three instances. A personal foul is committed on any offensive player during his team's transition scoring opportunity. I read that again. A personal foul is committed on any offensive player during his team's transition score. Okay, so I guess that means, that, like, an illegal screen. Yeah, I guess, like, if it's like a holding back of a player or something like that. Maybe I'm not really configuring the rule well, but I think that's what it means. And the next one is, when the foul occurs, the ball is ahead of the tip of the circle in the backcourt. Tip of the circle means, like, literally, the logo circle in the middle of the court. They do the jump ball before every game. No defensive player is ahead of the offensive player with a scoring opportunity, and that offensive player is in control of the ball or pass miss. So the next two in the defensive foul deprives the offensive team of a transition scoring opportunity. So that's what I mentioned. Like, and it may not even be in the half court or like past, and when the other team is in their bucket. It's when you just stop it just to do a foul, just because you want to slow the game down and stuff like that. So those cheap fouls that can slow the game down are no longer going to be implemented I guess that's what's being done. And so in this instance, a clear path foul. The team is given two free throw attempts and position on the sideline closest to the ball. And this would help because this would eliminate the play to start in the backcourt. So you don't have to take the ball all the way back. You just start half court. You know, we're getting, NBA's getting smarter. They're making sensible rule changes, unlike its counterpart, the NFL, which doesn't really know what they're doing and still can't explain a catch rule to us. And they're doing the helmet rule, which is just disgusting, which we've seen. I'm going to talk about this in the second half. Is that we're seeing, Noah and I talk about the fundamentals of tackling, but we're just seeing all of these penalty calls, and I understand that has a little bit to do with the preseason and all that stuff, but it's just, it's so annoying seeing all, so frustrating seeing almost a penalty every single play call. Comes at coaching, could be refs, but we'll get more on that in the second half. But then the last one is, the expanded definition of a hostile act to trigger instant replay will now extend beyond interaction with another player, to include an interaction with a hostile interaction with the referee, coach, or fan. And I like this because if you watch sports, any sport, except maybe not baseball, but they have their own problems. And we'll start with football. In football, a flag is thrown, you see 3, 4, 5, 6 players from each team huddling on the ref, and the refs have to constantly push them away. You go to soccer, a foul is made, no matter how clear as day the foul is. A captain of each team and 6 players are screaming in the ref's face. And he's only by himself, and he has to put his hands up and say, get away, back off, back off. In the NBA now, they're saying, okay, you want to huddle and you want to dog cuss out a ref like Draymond Green does every single play, where he's screaming, that's BS, that's this, that's that, that's soft. You know what? That's hostile. I assume that means it's going to be in hostile interaction. Referees can now go review that and assess the technical foul. And this may sound like, you know, it could be like, oh, we're going to eliminate emotion of these players. We're going to eliminate emotion, all this stuff. Well, not really. Not really. We're not going to eliminate emotion. You can be emotional. There's a fine line between being emotional and acting like a child and screaming if you get a foul call. When you look up and you slap them on the wrist, yes, there's going to be times where you're called for a soft foul. There's going to be times where you're not called for, you get away with hacking someone and stuff like that. That's in every sport. These refs are human. You know, I don't want robots reffing. I want the human element. Yes, I want perfection, as close to perfection as possible. But if we're getting robots, then you know how many fouls would be called in the NBA and all these sports where there's in NFL and soccer? If we have it, like, I don't know, what do you want? Like, you want, we're like body suits, like body sensors, and if you get tagged, the ref gets a little signal in his headset. Oh, yeah, that was a foul. Call that foul. No, we don't want that. We want context. We want everything like that. That's why in the NBA, in the last 2 minutes, especially in the playoffs, you can get away with almost anything you want. And yes, it's just, I of all of the rule changes the ESPN, the NFL is doing, this is the top of my list. Make sure you got to, because refs, for the referees to do their best, they have to, be able to have the space around them to make sensible decisions. And I really just want someone to get. I didn't really get the full gist of this because they didn't really explain it in detail of what this will mean. But players, I mean, I feel like the player coach thing's not going to be that bad. I think it's going to be the referee's player part of it. And fans is one thing too, because fans can get away with anything. I've always said, I think the fan aspect of games where you can say whatever you want is a little frustrating. But now that we are at a level of, I don't know where I was going with this, but now that we are at a level of respect, I feel like there should be respect, like fans, oh, they're talking about fans, sorry about that, I'm trying to get 7 things done real quick. But the fan aspect of this is, we can get away with saying anything we want to these human beings and nothing's going to happen to us. If players want to bark back, they should be able to bark back. That's why I love that Russell Westbrook will go back and he'll look at the fan. He'll snap. Well, people knock phones out of. That's knocking a phone out of hand is one thing. That's a little. But still, just the same thing like that. But I'm going to end this, just quickly end the first hour with, you know, making referees are usually the most hated people in sports, but that's such a difficult job to do. It's so difficult to make split-second decisions, and they are the best in the world at it. I mean, we are couch referees. We have replays. We should use them, but there comes a line where I appreciate the human element, and I appreciate what they do, so anything to make their job as easy as possible so they can focus on the game. So they're getting screamed at and hollered at by everyone. You know what? They go to a camera. They review. This guy was yelling in my face. He needs to be assessed technical foul. And if he does it again, we're throwing him out of the game. Because people, because unless you hold them accountable, they will keep doing it. So just want to throw a little NBA talk to conclude that. We're going to get back. Second half of the hour is going to be, I'm going to start off my thoughts with Urban Meyer. College football season actually starts this weekend. I'm not going to go in too much detail, but I'll give my predictions. Because I'll do some research today. I'll give my predictions because when the next show airs, the games are going to be kicking off and stuff like that. So we'll go through that. And I want to talk about the Bucks preseason, a little bit of a preseason talk about that. So we're going to be back for part two of the Fern podcast on the Radio St. Pete Network after these messages and station identification.